listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Tuesday, March the 26th, 2024. In the headlines, the Israel Air Force hits Hezbollah deep in Lebanon after fire on an airbase and firing of dozens of rockets at northern communities. Israel recalls its negotiating team on a hostage deal from Qatar, accusing Hamas of delusional demands. A released hostage reveals she was sexually assaulted in captivity, the first to speak publicly on the matter. U.S. Defense Secretary Austin tells his Israeli counterpart, Gallant, that protection of Palestinian civilians is a strategic necessity. A cabinet meeting on the controversial yeshiva draft law is canceled after efforts continue to secure coalition agreement on the matter. The weather outlook for the time of year, hot. Good evening. This is Nomi Segal with the news. Israel has decided to recall its negotiating team from Qatar, accusing Hamas of presenting delusional demands for a hostage deal. The Prime Minister's Bureau issued a statement that described Hamas's announcement last night as regrettable proof of the damage that had been caused by the UN Security Council decision. Hamas has rejected every American compromise proposal and has reiterated its extreme demands, the statement said. An immediate end to the war, a complete IDF withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, and leaving the Hamas regime intact so that it might repeat time and again the October 7th massacre as it has pledged to do. According to the statement, Israel will continue to act to achieve all of the war's objectives, the release of all the hostages, the destruction of Hamas's military and government capabilities, and ensuring a situation in which the Gaza Strip no longer poses a threat to Israel. Last night, the Hamas announced that it has not changed the position it presented 10 days ago, adding that Israel's response failed to meet any of its demands: a full ceasefire, a withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, the return of displaced persons to their homes, and a serious prisoner exchange deal. Hamas placed full responsibility for the failure to reach a deal on Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israel. Meanwhile, Qatar stressed earlier today that part of the negotiating teams were still in Doha conducting talks. The foreign ministry spokesperson Majd al-Ansari told a news briefing that the United Nations Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza had not had an immediate impact on the ceasefire talks in Doha.
Regarding the Security Council resolution, we have said very clearly we welcome such a move because we welcome any international diplomatic initiative, whether it be regional or international, in support of ending this terrible conflict. And that is certainly coming from the Security Council in such language is very helpful, and we hope that this momentum would continue and that we can build on this decision to expedite the end of this war. We haven't seen any immediate effect on the talks. They are, as I said, they are ongoing as they were before this decision was taking place. Other statements, you know, that came out from the Israeli government are, you know, bilaterally between the U.S. and Israel, and they have not affected the talks as we speak right now. I can confirm that part of the negotiating teams are still here in Doha conducting.
Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesperson Majd al-Ansari speaking earlier today, and as we heard, the Israeli team has returned to Israel. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department spokesperson has responded to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's claim that the U.S. abstention in a U.N. Security Council vote yesterday on an immediate ceasefire agreement in Gaza had harmed the hostage talks, saying that that claim was inaccurate. The State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told a briefing that Hamas's response in the hostage release negotiations had been submitted prior to the UN debate and not as claimed. The Hamas Political Bureau Director, Ismail Haniyeh, is in Tehran at the head of a Hamas delegation, and he's expected to meet with Iranian leaders to discuss the recent developments. Meanwhile, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant is continuing his talks in Washington against the backdrop of the increased strains in ties between Jerusalem and Washington, which reached a new height after Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday canceled a scheduled trip by senior aides to the U.S. in protest over the U.S. abstention in the U.N. Security Council resolution vote on a Gaza ceasefire, which did not link it to the release of hostages, but just called for the release of hostages. Gallant met today with his American counterpart, Lloyd Austin. He also has talks scheduled with the CIA chief, Bill Burns, and special envoy, Amos Hochstein. Here are comments from Gallant and Austin before the start of their meeting.
Over the past 6 months, we have been fighting a war against a brutal terror organization, Hamas, which is the ISIS of Gaza. We also face attacks from 7 different fronts, all led by Iran. While I sit here in the Pentagon, Hamas leader Haniyeh is meeting with Iranian leadership. The picture is clear. Who is well? Today, we will discuss developments in Gaza and the means to achieve our goals, the destruction of Hamas organization and bringing back the Israeli hostages back home. The negotiation on the hostage issue and Hamas positions require us to join hands in our military and diplomatic efforts and to increase pressure on Hamas. I will also raise the growing threats on our northern border and our commitment to returning displaced communities to their homes. We will also discuss strategic issues and the important cooperation between our establishment, which will ensure Israel's military edge and capabilities.
Now, it's been nearly 6 months since the Hamas atrocities of October 7th, the worst day in Israel's history. No country should endure such terror, and no country would tolerate such danger. So President Biden has been clear. Israel has a right to defend itself like any other state. So we're working with Israel to ensure that an outrage like October 7th can never happen again. And the United States will not rest until all the hostages are home. Our goal is to make Israel and the region safer and more secure. And as I have consistently said, protecting Palestinian civilians from harm is both a moral necessity and a strategic imperative. In Gaza today, the number of civilian casualties is far too high, and the amount of humanitarian aid is far too low. Gaza is suffering a humanitarian catastrophe, and the situation is getting even worse. And we need immediate increases in assistance to avert famine, and our work to open a temporary humanitarian corridor by sea will help, but the key is still expanding aid deliveries by land. So, Mr. Minister, I look forward to discussing how we can dramatically and urgently ease the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The safety of the 1.5 million Palestinian civilians in Rafah is also a top priority for the United States. Now, we continue to share the goal of seeing Hamas defeated. So we'll discuss alternative approaches to target Hamas elements. We must also plan for Israel's security after this conflict ends. And that includes working in renewed cooperation with the Palestinian Authority and our regional partners to stabilize Gaza and to move toward a two-state solution. Your security bond is, our security bond is unshakable. The United States is Israel's closest friend, and that won't change. And so I look forward to a good discussion today. And again, thanks for being here, Mr. Minister.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Defense Minister Gallant met yesterday with the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Gallant posted afterwards that he discussed developments in the war against Hamas and the military operations required to destroy Hamas as a military and governing authority in Gaza. He said he emphasized that Israel will not cease operating in Gaza until the return of all the hostages. A Khan reporter says Gallant raised in his discussions the possibilities that Israel will act in Rafah and presented plans for evacuating civilians. A readout from the U.S. State Department on the meeting said that Blinken reiterated the United States' support for ensuring the defeat of Hamas, including in Rafah, while reiterating opposition to a major ground operation in Rafah that would further jeopardize the welfare of the more than 1.4 million Palestinian civilians sheltering there. The secretary underscored that alternatives exist to a major ground invasion that would both better ensure Israel's security and protect Palestinian civilians. Blinken also discussed the need to immediately surge and sustain additional humanitarian assistance to meet the needs of civilians in Gaza. Turning to the northern arena, which has been heating up, Israeli security forces have confirmed that the Israel Air Force carried out strikes overnight on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard sites in Syria that served as a base for smuggling weapons to terror elements for the purpose of attacking Israel. A Khan reporter says the sites included Syrian army bases where Quds Force personnel operated as part of the special operations branch headed by Jad Afari. The strike came hours after the IDF and Shin Bet revealed that they had thwarted an Iran-directed infrastructure for the smuggling of advanced arms to terrorists in Judea and Samaria. The seized munitions included mines, explosives, anti-tank rockets, and rifles. Iran's embassy in Damascus confirmed that a member of the Revolutionary Guard was killed in the strike in Syria. Syrian opposition sources had said 8 Iranian militia operatives were killed in one of the strikes, among them an Iranian advisor from the Revolutionary Guards. Meanwhile, the IDF has confirmed carrying out another wave of strikes against Hezbollah in northeastern Lebanon's Baalbek region a short while ago after the terror group fired a barrage of some 50 rockets at northern Israel. The strike, the second in the area today, targeted another military compound used by Hezbollah's aerial unit, which included a launch pad for drones in several buildings. The IDF said it intercepted some of the 50 rockets fired in the barrage, with the remaining striking open areas. Separately, the IDF said fighter jets struck a Hezbollah weapons depot and another site. Earlier today, Hezbollah attacked the Israel Air Force air control base in the Mount Meron area. The IDF spokesperson said that no one was injured in this latest attack on the base and that the unit's operational capabilities were not damaged. As we heard, dozens of rockets were fired today toward Upper Galilee communities and Katrin on the Golan Heights. There were no reports of injuries. Several rockets were intercepted. Also today, a winery in Moshav Avivim was severely damaged by 3 anti-tank missiles that were fired from Lebanon. No one was injured, and firefighters were sent to the area. Rocket alerts also sounded today in Kibbutz Hanita in the Western Galilee. And last night, 14 rockets were fired out of the Gaza Strip toward Ashdod, Gaza periphery communities, and the Chof Ashkelon Regional Council. The Iron Dome intercepted 3 rockets that were fired at Sderot around midnight last night. Amit Susanna, who was kidnapped from Kibbutz Kfar Aza on October 7th and released from captivity on the last day of a week-long truce in November, has revealed that she was sexually assaulted and attacked by her Hamas captors during her captivity. In an interview with the New York Times, she said one of the guards sexually assaulted her under threat of a gun. She said she was also beaten by guards. Susanna was held in at least six different locations during her captivity, including private homes, an office, and a tunnel. The New York Times reported that her remarks on the sexual assault were consistent with a testimony she gave doctors and social workers she met less than a day after release from captivity. Susanna, who is the first released hostage to speak publicly about the sexual assault she suffered, said she did so to raise awareness to the suffering of the remaining hostages. Earlier this month, the United Nations published a report indicating that rape and gang rape likely occurred during the October 7th Hamas onslaught, and that there's clear and convincing evidence showing that hostages were raped while being in Gaza, and that those currently held captive are still facing such abuse. Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists who were apprehended during the IDF operations in Shifa Hospital have revealed in questioning how the medical facility was used for terror purposes. In documentation from the interrogation room of an intelligence unit, the terrorists revealed that hundreds of Hamas operatives hid in the hospital, about 600 to 1,000. They described orderly infrastructure used by senior Hamas figures in the hospital and weapons that were stored there. One of those questioned, an Islamic Jihad member, said that operatives were in all of the structures in the compound. Another terrorist said that the Islamic Jihad set up a command center in a maternity ward. The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, meanwhile, has accused the IDF of carrying out acts of genocide in Gaza and called for placing Israel under an arms embargo. Albanese today presented to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva the findings of a report that she prepared for the body and accused Israel of intentionally distorting rules of international law in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinians.
One of my key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted rules of international humanitarian law, distinction, proportionality, and precaution in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people by deliberately stretching the definitions of human shield, evacuation orders, warnings, safe zones, collateral damage, and medical protection, Israel has used their protective function as humanitarian camouflage, with the effect of concealing patterns of conduct from which the only inference can reasonably be drawn is a state policy of genocidal violence against the Palestinians, blurring the distinction between protected civilians or civilian infrastructure and combatants or legitimate military targets. Israel has effectively characterized the whole civilian population in Gaza as human shields or terrorist accomplices as a matter of legal policy. Those who managed to evacuate to areas that Israel defined as safe humanitarian zones have been met with further attacks, their deaths and injuries justified as collateral damage. By making repeated claims which have been systematically discredited that Hamas used hospitals as operation centers, Israel appears to be operating on the premise that if you tell a lie long enough, people will believe it. Israel has used the camouflage of humanitarian law to characterize the entire Palestinian people and life-sustaining and life-saving infrastructure of Gaza as targetable, killable, destroyable. Israel has attempted to legitimize, for example, the devastations of Gaza's medical infrastructure, which has led to potentially thousands of additional deaths, life-changing injuries and trauma. IHL has thus been distorted to justify a war of annihilation. In light of this, I find that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the commission of the crime of genocide against Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met. Specifically, Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. Denial of the reality and the continuation of Israel's impunity and exceptionalism is no longer viable. Especially in light of yesterday's binding Security Council resolution, I implore member states to abide by their obligations, which start with imposing an arms embargo and sanctions on Israel.
Special Investigator Francesca Albanese. Israel rejected the report as an obscene inversion of reality. The Israeli diplomatic mission in Geneva said the report brings shame on the 47-country rights body and blasted Albanese for a campaign of delegitimizing the very creation and existence of the State of Israel. Since the war, she has continued this campaign unabated, excusing and legitimizing the attacks of October 7th, dismissing their anti-Semitic nature and dismissing any concrete evidence of acts of savagery that were perpetrated on that day, the mission said. It is clear from the report that the special rapporteur began with the conclusion that Israel is committing genocide and then tried to prove her distorted and politically driven views with weak arguments and justifications. The United States has said that Israel is not violating international law in its use of U.S.-supplied weapons, the State Department spokesperson said at a briefing yesterday. In remarks to reporters, Matthew Miller said Washington has deemed Israel to be in compliance with a new national security memorandum after it received a written assurance from Jerusalem that it is using American weapons in line with international law and is not blocking humanitarian assistance in Gaza.
We have had ongoing assessments about their compliance with their national humanitarian law. I've spoke to them from this podium before. We have the CHERD process that is examining specific incidents. We have not found them to be in violation of international humanitarian law, either when it comes to the conduct of the war or when it comes to the provision of humanitarian assistance. So we view their assurances through that ongoing work that we have done. And I should make clear, those ongoing assessments are not something that started because of the National Security Memorandum, and they're not something that stopped because we got these assurances from Israel yesterday. They will be ongoing when we get credible reports or credible allegations of misconduct. We look at them through the process that we have ongoing, and ultimately we will make the appropriate conclusions. And to the extent that we are able to do so in the report that's due on May 8th, they will be provided to Congress through that report.
You yourselves have discussed the civilian casualties, the civilian toll there in Gaza. So, I mean, is that consistent with it? I mean, so you think that even though there's a civilian toll, that the that the use of U.S. weapons, that there are the credible assurances that have been given there, is that inconsistent at all to say that?
So they have given us assurances. I would say when it comes to finding a violation of international humanitarian law, that requires a fact-intensive analysis of relevant factors related to international humanitarian law. So you've heard me speak to this before. If you're to assess whether a particular strike is in compliance with international humanitarian law, you have to know who was the target of the strike. You have to know what steps they took to minimize civilian harm. You have to know to what extent that they were successful. And so we have ongoing processes to look at those things. And those were processes that started before this memorandum was signed by the president. There were processes that were ongoing before we received these assurances, and they're processes that will continue to be ongoing. But as of yet, we have not made a conclusion that Israel is in violation of international humanitarian law.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller. The United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process said today that the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip will only get worse if Israel proceeds with planned ground operations in Rafah. Briefing the UN Security Council during a periodic briefing on the situation in the Middle East, Tor Venneslund called on Israel to fulfill its obligation under international law and facilitate the rapid and unimpeded humanitarian access into and throughout Gaza. The Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Robert Wood, told the Council at the meeting today that the United States shares Israel's view that Israel must be eliminated, but opposes a broad Israeli military operation in Rafah and continues to convey this view to Israeli officials.
We continue to advise against a major ground operation into Rafah. We share Israel's goal of defeating Hamas, which is responsible for the worst massacre of the Jewish people since the Holocaust. As we have said, though, a major military ground operation in Rafah is not the way to do it. It risks killing more civilians. It risks wreaking greater havoc with the provision of humanitarian assistance. And so our advice to Israel is, there is a better way. That is a message that President Biden, Secretary Blinken, Secretary Austin, and Ambassador Thomas Greenfield all have communicated to senior Israeli officials in recent weeks, and we will continue to emphasize.
Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Robert Wood. Turning to politics, the cabinet vote on the new military draft bill for ultra-Orthodox that was scheduled to take place this afternoon was postponed because ministers failed to agree on an acceptable compromise. No new date has been set for a cabinet discussion, even though tomorrow is the final date for the state to respond to the petitions that were submitted to the High Court of Justice on the issue of the military draft. Econ Reporter says the state is likely to request an extension. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been meeting with various political actors in an attempt to hammer out an agreement. Before the postponement, the prime minister assured the members of his own party who are opposed to the bill that its wording would be changed before being put to a Knesset vote. Netanyahu said there won't be a government without a military draft bill, and he went on to say that he would not accept any no votes. At least two ministers from the Likud party left their meetings with the prime minister yesterday without promising to vote in favor of the bill. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant has instructed defense ministry officials not to cooperate with the prime minister's bureau on the bill. Gallant, who is currently in Washington, is trying to do so to prevent a cabinet resolution regarding the proposed legislation from being passed in his absence. Meanwhile, Knesset member Matan Kahana of the National Unity Party said his country will pull out of the government if it feels the prime minister is not really advancing a bill on the yeshiva draft issue, but engaging instead in all manner of maneuvers and tricks. Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee Chair Yuli Edelstein announced he would not allow his committee to be circumvented on the draft bill. Edelstein said, regrettably, I have begun to hear rumors that an attempt is being planned to circumvent the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee. Any attempt to do so to circumvent the Knesset bylaws and prevent the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee from addressing the military draft bill will be met with an apt response. Finance Ministry officials criticized the yeshiva draft bill, which they said would have far-reaching negative repercussions for the economy and would increase the military burden borne by individuals. The ministry sent a letter to the prime minister's office legal advisor demanding that the cabinet decision on the bill be amended because of the short amount of time finance ministry officials were given to comment on the proposed legislation. The letter also shared the finance ministry's projection that the proposed legislation would cost more than 100 billion shekels over the course of the coming decade. Professor Dan Ben-David is the president and founder of the Shoresh Institution for Socioeconomic Research and an economist at Tel Aviv University. He told reporter Mark Weiss that the controversy over the age of ultra-Orthodox exemption from military service misses the point and that the problems of the Haredi community go much deeper.
The argument right now is at what age should the ultra-Orthodox be given an exemption from the army? It was lowered in recent years to 24, and the reason is to encourage them to go and work at least at the age of 24 without having to go to the army. Now the government is considering raising it to 35 for political reasons, and my contention is that this is crazy and that's worse because we need the Haredim just like they need us, and we may have thought that we have a large enough army, and if we have, as they say abroad, a nuclear option, then we don't need a big army. And it turns out that we do, and it turns out that we need everyone, including them. And it's only going to make exacerbate the situation in the future when we look at their share in the population, which is doubling every 25 years. So if we look at a 50-year-old grandfather today, the Haredim are only 6% of that age group, but they're a quarter of their grandchildren, of the 0 to 4-year-old. It's really a population that's doubling every 25 years. We need them, and we need them not just in the army. We particularly need them in the labor market. So this is an issue of not whether the age of exemption should be 24 or 35, but there are rules and laws in Israel. Every one of us has to go to the army. Every one of us has to work for a living. They need to start doing the same. And that means that the main point that is being missed here is that they need to get a good education. They need to get the basic tools to work in a modern economy and to live in a modern society, modern liberal democratic society. And
Explain
we have a major problem in this regard.
Explain to our listeners, then, in broad strokes, why the leadership of the ultra-Orthodox community and politically and the parties that represent them in the Knesset would oppose this. Why do they oppose greater participation in both the military burden and being more active participants in the Israeli workforce?
There's no other way of putting it than the Haredi leadership is a bunch of cynical hypocrites that are determined to keep their own society, to deprive them of the information they need to make their own choices in life, to have opportunities in life. They want to control them. They want to have them completely dependent on their politicians' ability to get them welfare benefits. But it's not sustainable. It never was sustainable. And the rate that this is going will basically ensure that not only they take a deep dive, but they bring along the rest of the country with them. And that's unconscionable. And if their Haredim politicians don't recognize this problem, and by the way, they're not alone. It's the non-Haredi politicians that enable them. They basically mortgage our future for political expediency in the present. The Haredim have been the kingmakers for the past 50 years in Israel, for most of the past 50 years. And they take what they can from that, but in the meantime, they bury their own future along with ours.
I've been interviewing you now for more than a decade. Essentially, your message each time, your warning each time is the same. But things not only don't improve, things get progressively worse, as you just mentioned, because of the high, the demographic issue, the high Haredi birth rate. Each Haredi woman on average has more than six children. We're now in the situation that in the age group of between birth and 4 years old, more than one quarter of all children in Israel are ultra-Orthodox. If this trend continues and there's no drastic change, where do you see Israel in, say, 50 years from now?
The situation is much broader than just the Haredim. Roughly half the children today already are receiving a third world education in Israel, and they belong to the fastest growing parts of the population. So the situation is going to be deteriorating a lot more quickly than we can imagine. When these children grow up, they won't be able to support a first world economy, which means no first world health care or welfare benefits, but also no first world army. And that's what distinguishes us from other countries that deteriorate and become third world countries. This third world country will not be able to defend itself. It won't exist. So I don't know if it'll happen in 30, 40, 50 years, but at some point, we will not be able to defend ourselves, and God help our children and grandchildren then. Because this is what's on the horizon right now. If we don't stop it while we can, there is a democratic point of no return in Israel's Knesset, where things that are already extremely difficult to even contemplate the possibility of their passing in today's Knesset at one point will be impossible to pass. And then it's just a matter of time until the deterioration just unfolds. So we need to stop it. I think one of the things that has happened over the past decade that you've been interviewing me is that this past year has shown us, it's given us a glimpse of the future, what it may look like. Because we have a criminal defendant as prime minister who no other normal political party would touch with a 10-foot pole. His only choice was to go with two Haredi parties and three very racist parties. And the thing is that we saw what these guys are going to do in the future when they won't need a criminal defendant as prime minister, because the demographics will take care of business for them and they'll have a majority in any event. So if that preview this past year, even before October 7th, is not something that we want to see a repeat of, then we need to do something about it. We need to wake up and smell the roses, because we just got the biggest clarion, or the loudest clarion call that you can imagine this past year, and we need to do something about it.
A few weeks ago, I interviewed an ultra-Orthodox man who relatively liberal, but still from the ultra-Orthodox community. Mm-hmm. He said there is a change in the ultra-Orthodox community, and there is a growing willingness to share the military burden. Do you see any signs of this?
Well, I think that at the grassroots, this isn't a problem. We don't have a problem with the Haredim. We have a problem with the Haredi leadership. We see more and more Haredim that want to go to higher education. But here's the catch. If they don't study what they need as children, their dropout rates are phenomenal. Over three-quarters of the men do not graduate. So their graduation rates, even though more and more have gone in that direction, they don't have the ability to graduate. The graduation rates have been constant for the past 20 years. The fact that they want to gives you a sense that this is something that we need to basically do despite their leadership, to save them from their leadership and to save us from our leadership and their leadership. What you could get an example of this from the previous government when the communications minister at the time wanted to enable Haredi to move with their phones to other companies rather than just the Haredi-owned or controlled phone companies, which would then give them access to other internet sites, other basically access to the rest of the world, which is something that all Israelis have. We can move from one company to the other and retain our number. The thing is that the Haredi phones have the same number, and that's the way that the Haredi leadership knows that everyone is playing the game. And once they don't know that they're going to other companies, then they lose control over what they know. And they went berserk. They went out in the streets. They called the government Nazis. It just, the Haredim are thirsty for knowledge. They need the knowledge like any normal society. But we are allowing basically a leadership to deprive them of what they need and what we need them to know. And that's just unconscionable.
Professor Dan Ben-David, president and founder of the Shoresh Institution for the Socioeconomic Research and an economist at Tel Aviv University. Taking a midway look at the headlines this evening, the Israel Air Force hits Hezbollah deep in Lebanon after fire on an Israel Air Force airbase and northern communities. Israel recalls its negotiating team and a hostage deal from Qatar, accusing Hamas of delusional demands. A released hostage reveals she was sexually assaulted in captivity, the first to speak publicly on the matter. U.S. Defense Secretary Austin tells Israeli counterpart protection of Palestinian civilians is a strategic necessity. A cabinet meeting on the controversial yeshiva draft law is postponed as efforts continue to secure coalition agreement on the matter. And the weather outlook hot for the time of year. The IDF spokesperson, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, is giving his evening briefing and has confirmed that Marwan Issa, the number three in Hamas, a senior Hamas figure and deputy to the head of the Hamas military wing, was assassinated. In his briefing, the spokesperson said that the Shifa hospital operation is continuing and has so far Israeli security forces together with the Shin Bet have arrested more than 500 known Islamic and Hamas terrorists, among them those who have provided significant intelligence information. He also confirmed that the Israel Air Force carried out strikes deep in Lebanon today, striking two significant compounds of Hezbollah air units, and this in response to earlier rocket fire on the air control base by Mount Meron, where two anti-tank missiles were fired, and the firing of dozens of rockets at northern Israel. He said there were no injuries and no impact on the operational capabilities of the airbase. Following a stormy debate, the Knesset House Committee voted 8-3 today to approve the legislature's annual spring recess, despite widespread calls to cancel the break in light of the war and the ongoing controversy surrounding the government's proposed ultra-Orthodox enlistment legislation. During the meeting, families of hostages chanted shame in an attempt to press the committee chair to cancel the break. Chen Avigdori, whose wife and daughter were freed from Hamas captivity, berated the legislators for voting for their own recess and said he would take a good hard look at what each MK who raises his hand in favor of the break does. He clashed verbally with United Torah Judaism MK Yitzhak Pindrus, who interjected dismissively, "Yalla, yalla." In the wake of that exchange, opposition Knesset member Gilad Kariv of Labor lodged a complaint with the Knesset Ethics Committee against Pindrus, saying his coarse words to hostage families are proof he is not worthy of serving in Israel's parliament. And in Tel Aviv this evening, demonstrators, including families of hostages, have been protesting outside the Kiryah. This over the return of the Israeli negotiating team from Doha. They are demanding a hostage release deal now. Returning to the strains in Israel-U.S. ties, Chalit Bar-El, a former senior official in Israel's National Security Council and a founding member of the Dvorah Forum for the Empowerment of Women in Foreign and Security Roles, analyzed the diplomatic tension leading up to the United States withholding its veto power at the UN in a resolution considered unfavorable by Israel in a conversation with the Jerusalem Press Club.
It's obviously been a very long road, at the beginning of which we saw very strong support, absolute support from the United States. That one must state has been continued support and pretty consistent on the level of the military assistance, the financial assistance that Israel has been receiving throughout this war. Of course, it's no secret that there has been quite a dispute between the Biden administration and the Netanyahu government about where are we going with all of this? What's the day after? What are we looking to have in Gaza? What are we looking to have in the Middle East? The stagnation on that level, on the political level, has definitely brought a lot of tension into the relations between the two nations. It's not the first time that the United States hasn't vetoed one of these decisions. I believe in December, there was one around humanitarian assistance, humanitarian aid, that was also opposed by Israel, but not vetoed by the United States, if I'm not mistaken. But this one is a more meaningful one. And I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as going against Israel. Certainly Israel opposed this and would have preferred it not to pass. But I would say it's a decision that is working against the negotiations that are currently ongoing with regard to the return of the hostages, potential movement of population up to northern Gaza Strip, and any kind of limited ceasefire, for the simple reason that Hamas is touting this as a victory. And to the extent that Sinwar actually believes that he has some sort of victory in this decision, and that he can somehow obtain a cessation of the fire or an end to this war before these negotiations are completed, to the extent that he erroneously received that message from the UN decision, the UN Security Council decision, then that prolongs the negotiation, which of course hurts Israel very much, because every day our hostages are away is to our detriment. That is the number one goal of these negotiations, to return the hostages. So to the extent that this will actually provide for the extension of the negotiations and stronger positions by Hamas, that certainly has hurt both Israeli interests, but the interest, I think, of the entire world, certainly the United States. And so the decision, certainly it would have been better if it wasn't passed. However, when we look at the Israeli response, it's not exactly clear why Israel is making this connection to not sending a delegation to the United States and kind of exacerbating the situation or creating a greater rift between Israel and the United States. I think it is imperative that we discuss the issue of Rafah. I think it is imperative that the United States understands, which I believe they do, but it needs to be ironed out, that Rafah has to be dealt with, whether it is through a military, full military attack or other means. It has to be dealt with. It's a real problem. It is the last stronghold of Hamas. It is where its leaders are hiding. It's Hamas's hope for continuing to rule and govern in the Gaza Strip and regain its position after this is all over. And therefore, there's no scenario in which Israel can really accept that. And in addition, we have to discuss the border between Rafah and Egypt with the United States, because clearly there was a big issue with the border there, and Gaza did not get to have the kind of strength, the Hamas not get those kind of means of war, and did not build its underground metro without a lot of stuff coming in through Rafah. And that cannot continue. We have to be in Israel convinced that that situation is resolved in a real way and not just on paper. So these discussions between Israelis and Americans are of paramount importance. We listen to the prime minister and he hasn't sent his delegation, but we also know that Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant is there, and hopefully they are discussing those issues, because Israeli national interests are at stake.
Can you say perhaps whether the specific response by the U.S. now is related solely to the war, or is the fact that this is an election year in the U.S. is affecting that decision, as well as the makeup of the government in Israel?
Well, it's clear that internal politics, domestic politics, always play a role in every country, in every situation. We have a situation here within Israel with a very fragile government, very problematical political situation for Prime Minister Netanyahu. And certainly there have been multiple accusations about him being motivated by his political motivations. And certainly same accusations are being wielded towards the Biden administration, that they're doing this, that, or the other, mostly catering to their base by making things more difficult to Israel because it is an election year. However, I think it's very interesting to note that we heard former President Trump and the Republican nominee say similar things, in the sense of Israel will have to go to a ceasefire as soon as possible. The war must end, and talking about peace. So in those statements, Trump and Biden, who are contending one against each other, seem to be choosing the same line. So when we look at it from Israel, I'm not sure at the end of the day, it doesn't sound like a Democratic versus a Republican. I'm sure it is a contention for every vote. So if both of them have, for whatever reasons, discerned that there are votes that they might be losing because of extra support to Israel, still, when the Republican nominee and the Democratic nominee sound the same, then it begs the question whether this is really something that that you can hang your hat on. I'm sure election considerations in the United States are coming into it. On the other hand, I do remember that we were already in an election year on October 7th when the United States stood very sternly next to Israel. And so I would say certainly those are some of the calculations. Certainly they're not the only ones. I believe that the United States had made clear its position from day one that they are asking Israel for a goal, a political goal. Where is this? Where shall we be at the end of all this? And that has not been answered. And that had been a point of contention between Israel and the United States. And I believe it will continue to be, if things remain the same, no matter who the next president of the United States is.
Even knowing that the government in Israel is not changing today or tomorrow, going forward, what can Israel do to repair relations, or at least to bring them back to normality?
Well, first of all, I think we have to rein in all of these disputes, make them less public and less noisy. I think disputes between Israel and the United States have always existed about the way forward, and Israel absolutely has to continue and stand up for its national security interests. For example, with the issue of how do we deal with Rafah. However, these need to be done as is done between allies. The United States is not only not our enemy, it is our staunchest ally. The strategic relations between the United States and Israel are a pillar of Israeli national security, and in fact of American security interests. And so I think from the Israeli side, reining in all of the rhetoric that we're hearing from a lot of ministers in the government is imperative, and reining in Netanyahu himself has to rein in his responses. I think this last response is surprising, was very impetuous, probably not very well calculated. And so I think we have to certainly maintain our stance, for example, are insistent on the fact that this decision in the Security Council should have been prevented, but at the same time understanding that what we are doing by harming this strategic relationship is making Hezbollah and particularly Iran very happy, and that is exactly countering to our interests. So Israel has to take a more pragmatic tone. And hopefully on both sides, United States and Israel, no more personal accusations, and getting back to working together and moving towards some sort of pragmatic resolution of the situation in its entirety, in terms of this this hostage deal that we hope is coming up. This is not the time to fight. This is the time to return our hostages home. This is the proclaimed goal of both the United States and Israel. So must work together. This is no time for these kind of skirmishes.
Khalid Bar-El, former senior official at Israel's National Security Council and a founding member of the Dvorah Forum. Foreign Minister Yisrael Katz met with his visiting German counterpart Annalena Baerbock and said afterwards they agreed on cooperation in advancing humanitarian issues as part of the effort to preserve international legitimacy of the continued war against Hamas. He said he made clear Israel will continue to operate forcefully until the return of the hostages and the defeat of Hamas in Gaza. The German foreign minister called the humanitarian situation in Gaza hell and said international aid organizations must be allowed to bring aid to the Palestinians. Abroad briefly, in the United States, a container ship rammed into a major bridge in Baltimore early Tuesday, causing it to snap and plunge into the river below. Several vehicles fell into the chilly waters and rescuers were searching for survivors. Maryland's governor said the cargo ship lost power and its crew issued a Mayday call moments before the crash, enabling authorities to limit vehicle traffic on the span. Two people were rescued from the waters under the Francis Scott Key Bridge, one in serious condition, according to the Baltimore Fire Chief, James Wallace. He earlier said that authorities may be looking for upwards of seven people, but that number could change. It was subsequently adjusted to six.
We are still very much in an active search and rescue posture at this point, and we will continue to be for some time. We have a large area that we have to search. This includes on the surface of the water, subsurface, as well as on the deck of the ship itself. We believe at this point we may be looking for upwards of seven individuals. That's the latest information we have. However, what I will say is the information that I'm giving you right now is as of right now. That's what we know right now. The latest information we have on the crew of the ship is that they are still on board the ship. There's been comms between the ship crew and the Coast Guard. So as part of the overall operation, we communicate through the Coast Guard with the ship. Don't have a number. I can tell you our sonar has detected the presence of vehicles submerged in the water. I don't have a count of that yet. We do believe that at least seven are involved in that, at least seven at this point. So we'll be guided by our dive teams. We will determine what the temperature of the water is. The other issue that we have out there is this water is current influenced. So right now we think the tide is coming back in. That adds a bit of a challenge to us also. We can certainly dive in these conditions, but we have to take a lot of factors into play, right? The fact that there may be trauma involved, they have been in the water an extended period of time. But also remember, we're battling darkness. So, you know, it's quite possible that we may have somebody there that we've not seen yet. And as they work closer to the debris field, you know, they'll obviously make those determinations.
Baltimore Fire Chief James Wallace. Finally, Israeli songwriter David Chalfon passed away last night at the age of 73. He was laid to rest in Or Yehuda. In 2013, he was awarded the city's prize for artistry and creativity, and a few months ago, he was given the Freedom of the City honor. Chalfon wrote music for numerous other artists, including Shlomi Shabbat, Sarit Haddad, and Eyal Golan. Among his well-known songs are Your Eyes Talk, Illusions, and God Gave You a Gift, sung by Eitan Mussouri.
דבר גדול, דבר נפלא. אלוהים נתן לך במתנה את החיים על פני האדמה. נתן לך את הלילה והיום, אהבה, תקווה וחלום, קיץ, חורף, סתיו, אביב. נשמה טובה להביט סביב. נתן לך שדות ירוקים, פרחים ועצים מלבלבים, נהרות, נחלים וימים, שמיים, ירח, כוכבים. אלוהים נתן לך במתנה דבר גדול, דבר נפלא. אלוהים נתן לך במתנה את החיים על פני האדמה. נתן לך חגים ושבתות, את ישראל ארץ האבות, ידיים וראש להגשים חלומות. נתן לך את כל הנפלאות, נתן לך דברים כל כך יפים, להביא לעולם ילדים, להאזין לשירים, לראות צבעים, אומר רבו מעשיך אלוהים. אלוהים נתן לך במתנה דבר גדול, דבר נפלא.
And the weather outlook. Tomorrow and Thursday will be hot for the time of year. Friday cooler, but still unseasonably warm. Chance of local rain from the afternoon hours, mostly in the south and east. Saturday calls for local rain, mostly in the north. The temperatures forecast for tonight and tomorrow: Jerusalem 8 to 22, Tel Aviv 14 to 25, Haifa 13 to 24, Tzfat 8 to 20, Tiberias 12 to 25, Beersheba 12 to 29, and in Eilat, from 14 degrees tonight going up to 31 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Taking another look at the news headlines, the IDF spokesperson in a evening briefing has confirmed that Marwan Issa, the deputy commander of Hamas's military wing, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in the central Gaza Strip earlier this month. Alongside Issa, another senior Hamas commander was killed. He also said that three senior Hamas figures have been among those arrested in the recent IDF and Shin Bet operations in Shifa Hospital. The Israel Air Force hits Hezbollah targets deep in Lebanon after fire on an Israel Air Force base and northern communities. Israel recalls its negotiating team on a hostage deal from Qatar, accusing Hamas of delusional demands. A released hostage reveals she was sexually assaulted in captivity, the first to speak publicly on the matter. U.S. Defense Secretary Austin tells his Israeli counterpart Gallant that protection of Palestinian civilians is a strategic necessity. A cabinet meeting on the controversial yeshiva draft law is postponed as efforts continue to secure coalition agreement on the matter. The weather outlook hot for the time of year. That's the news. Join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kan Reka, the foreign languages channel of the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation. Watch our 2 p.m. news flash on the Kan English Facebook page. Find us on Spotify, Twitter, or write to us at kanenglish@kan.org.il. Together with sound engineer Elad Zor, this is Nomi Segal wishing you good evening and shalom from Jerusalem.